but speechless with pleasure. Adams heard the Spanish ambassador praise him for his determination and spirit, saying he had struck the greatest blow that has been struck in the American cause, and the most decisive. It is you who have filled this nation with enthusiasm. It is you who have turned all on their heads. The tribute was one Adams would quote repeatedly in letters, and understandably, given his elation and the spirit of the moment. The American minister became the toast of the Dutch Republic. Poems and songs were written in celebration of American independence. Engraved portraits were published of the American heroes, Washington and Adams. Le Vauguyon, in a letter to Vergennes, reported that everywhere the recognition of America and the reception of Adams as envoy arouses the liveliest transports of joy. In May, Adams took up residence and put out a flag at the United States House, as he called it, the first American embassy anywhere in the world. Yet, for all this, his efforts to obtain Dutch financial help became no easier. And for all his own abundant self-satisfaction in the part he had played, he appreciated how much else had influenced the outcome. "The resolution which has taken place in this nation," he told Edmund Jennings, "is the result of a vast number and variety of events comprising the great scheme of Providence. When I recollect the circumstances, I am amazed and feel that it is no work of mine." At last, on June 11, 1782, Adams negotiated with a syndicate of three Amsterdam banking houses, Willink, Van Staphorst, and De La Lande and Fania, a loan of 5 million guilders, or $2 million, at 5% interest. It was not the $10 million Congress had expected Henry Lawrence to secure, but it was an all-important beginning. It was money desperately needed at home and a foundation for American credit in Europe. "If this had been the only action of my life, it would have been well spent," Adams wrote to Abigail, hoping she would pardon the vanity. He was writing to her again and at length. He thought it unlikely that anyone would understand or appreciate the struggle and aggravation he had been through, the doubts, timidity, and hostilities he had had to contend with. "I have rendered a most important and essential service to my country here, which I verily believe no other man in the world would have done," he confided. "I don't mean by this that I have exerted any abilities here or any action that are not very common, but I don't believe that any other man in the world would have had the patience and perseverance to do and to suffer what was absolutely necessary." Untrained in diplomacy, and by temperament seemingly so unsuited for it, he had indeed succeeded brilliantly, as others and history would attest. He thought it no life for him. "I must be an independent man," he reminded her, and possibly he was as ready to give it up as he claimed. "A child was never more weary of a whistle than I am of embassies." But nothing he had done in the service of his country had given such satisfaction. No matter that the Dutch Republic was one of the lesser theaters of Europe, or that other events in which he had played a decisive part would rank higher in the balance, it had been his own path that he had taken, alone and in his own way. He had been ignored, ridiculed. He had very nearly died in the process. Yet he had persisted and succeeded. "Sometimes it was necessary to be assuming," he observed in a letter to Edmund Jennings. Had he followed the advice and exhortations he was subjected to and suspended operations to request instructions, he would have been forbidden to proceed as he had, and most likely Holland would have signed a separate peace with England. "Thanks to God that he gave me stubbornness when I know I am right." Ironically, A letter was en route that June from Robert Livingston, demanding to know why, in his reports to Congress, Adams had included nothing about the dockyards and arsenals of Holland, or the ships preparing for sea, or anything about the leading members of the Dutch government. "You have not repeated your private conversations with them, from which infinitely more is to be collected than from all the pamphlets scattered about the streets," lectured Livingston, who had never set foot in Europe or served in a diplomatic role. "If they avoid your company and conversation, it is a more unfavorable symptom than any you have mentioned, and shows clearly that your public character should have been concealed till your address had paved the way for its being acknowledged. None of your letters take the least notice of the French ambassador at The Hague. Is there no intercourse between you? If not, to what is it to be attributed?" The news that the Dutch Republic had recognized the United States did not reach Philadelphia until September, arriving by a Dutch ship named Herr Adams. At noon, Tuesday, October 8, 1782, Adams arrived at the State House at The Hague to sign a treaty of commerce with the Dutch Republic. Deputies from the provinces of Holland and Zeeland stood waiting at the top of the stairs to escort him to the gilded Trefzaal, or Truce Hall. With its elaborate frescoed ceiling and tall French doors overlooking a small lake and fountain, it could have been a chamber at Versailles. And as the ceremony proceeded ever so slowly, Adams had ample time to look about. Finally, it was his turn. The treaty was signed and sealed, his work accomplished. Section 3. In late September, John Jay dispatched an urgent note to John Adams from Paris to report that the British emissary Richard Oswald had received a formal commission to treat with the United States on the matter of peace. Jay pressed Adams to come to Paris as soon as possible and cautioned that he say nothing of this till you see me. It was only with his treaty of commerce with the Dutch completed that Adams felt free to leave. But even then, he seems to have been in no hurry to get to Paris. He hardly knew what to think about the prospect of making peace, he told Abigail. It could be troublesome business, another furnace of affliction. Yet his spirits were high. "Yet I am very gay, more so than usual. I fear nothing. Why should I?" The third week of October, he started for Paris by carriage and 6 horses. With him were John Thaxter and an additional new secretary for the work at Paris, Charles Storer, a recent graduate of Harvard. Miserable weather slowed their progress. Unrelenting rain turned the road to a river of mud. The carriage broke down. But it was of Adams's own choice that he lingered over a private collection of Rubens' altarpiece at Antwerp and an altarpiece by Rubens that he thought beautiful beyond description. 25 miles north of Paris, he stopped again to tour the famous chateau at Chantilly, its stables and gardens, as though time were of no concern. It was a perfect autumn day that he would mark with a particularly lovely passage in his diary, revealing in a few lines the degree to which the hard-headed, intractable New Englander was, in the expression of the time, a man of sensibility. "While we were viewing the statue of Montmorency, Mademoiselle de Bourbon came out into the roundhouse at the corner of the castle, dressed in beautiful white, her hair uncombed, hanging and flowing about her shoulders, with a book in her hand, and leaned over the bar of iron. But soon perceiving that she had caught my eye, and that I viewed her more attentively than she fancied, she rose up with that majesty and grace which persons of her birth affect if they are not taught, turned her hair off of both her shoulders with her hands in a manner that I could not comprehend, and decently stepped back into the chamber and was seen no more." He reached Paris and the Hôtel de Valois that night. The following day, October 27th, having bathed in a public bathhouse by the Seine and called for the services of a Parisian tailor and wig maker, he was ready to take up his part in the negotiations. Much had already transpired, as Adams learned from meetings with John Jay and a young American merchant named Matthew Ridley, whom Adams had met earlier in Holland, and who, though he had no official role, seemed to know all that was going on. Jay had arrived in Paris from Spain in June, and through most of the summer, he and the British representative, Richard Oswald, had been in discussions centered on the recognition of American independence as a mandatory precursor to any talk of peace. Franklin had been absent from the talks, ill with the gout and bladder stones, and little progress was made. But in the last days of September, Oswald received word from London empowering him to treat with the ministers of the United States of America, not the American colonies, and at once the discussions took on a new air. From their first meeting, Jay and Adams found they were of like mind on most matters. "Mr. Adams is much pleased with Mr. Jay," Ridley wrote in his diary. "Mr. Adams is exceedingly pleased with Mr. Jay," Ridley added after several more meetings. Jay, in his diary, recorded only of Adams that he spoke freely what he thought. Jay was younger than Adams by 10 years. Born to wealth and position in New York, tall, slim, and pale, he appeared somewhat haughty, carrying himself with a lift of the chin that made his hawk nose an even more pronounced feature. Like Adams, he had distinguished himself in the law and in Congress, where the two men had gotten along well enough, if frequently at cross purposes on issues. Jay, too, could be combative and stubborn, and as the descendant of French Huguenots, he had little liking for the Bourbon court. Jay refused to negotiate with the British until recognition of American independence was settled, and in so doing deliberately ignored the instructions of Congress to abide by the wishes of the French. Vergennes had wanted the discussions to proceed irrespective of the point of independence. "Let independence wait upon the treaty," he had told Franklin. In fact, Vergennes had sent a secret envoy to London to hint to Lord Shelburne that France did not support all the demands of the Americans. Apparently, it was not until he reached Paris, not until his initial meetings with Jay, that Adams learned for the first time of the Commission's instructions from Congress to abide by the guidance of the French Foreign Ministry. Adams was outraged. America was not fighting a war for independence to be told what to do by the French. He wrote immediately to Robert Livingston to say he would rather resign than follow such instructions, and that he and Jay were perfectly agreed in their approach to the French. "I cannot express it better than in his own words, to be honest and grateful to our allies, but to think for ourselves. I find a construction put upon one article in our instructions by some persons which, I confess, I never put upon it myself. It is represented by some as subjecting us to the French ministry, as taking away from us all right of judging for ourselves, and obliging us to agree to whatever the French ministers should advise us to do, and to do nothing without their consent. I never supposed this to be the intention of Congress. If I had, I never would have accepted the commission, and if I now thought it their intention, I could not continue in it. I cannot think it possible to be the design of Congress. If it is, I hereby resign my place in the commission and request that another person may be immediately appointed in my stead." Disappointed with the cramped accommodations available to him this time at the Hôtel de Valois, Adams changed lodgings, moving to the Hôtel du Roi on the Place du Carrousel, between the Palais Royal and the Quai du Louvre, which was to remain his headquarters. Through most of the fall, Paris had been shrouded with dark skies, cold rain and fog, and the same grim weather continued, adding nothing to anyone's spirits. For days, Adams put off making contact with Franklin. After what Franklin had done to him, he told Matthew Ridley, he could hardly face the thought of going to Passy. When Ridley insisted he must, Adams agreed, but then, putting on his coat to leave, seemed to change his mind. "It was only with much persuasion that I got him at length to go," Ridley wrote. It would be the first time Adams had seen Franklin since Franklin had written his devastating letter to Congress on August 9, 1780. Exactly when Adams found out about the letter, or read its content, are not clear. But once, and apparently only once, he unburdened his pent-up fury in a letter written earlier that summer to Edmund Jennings. At the root of Franklin's behavior, Adams had convinced himself, was base jealousy. The possibility that his own feelings toward Franklin could have the same root cause seems not to have entered his mind. "His base jealousy of me and his sordid envy of my commission for making a treaty of commerce with Great Britain have stimulated him to attempt an assassination upon my character at Philadelphia, of which the world has not yet heard, and of which it cannot hear until the time shall come when many voluminous state papers may be laid before the public, which ought not to be until we are all dead." Still, Adams was determined not to let personal ire stand in the way of his duty regarding the work at hand. "That I have no friendship for Franklin, I avow. That I am incapable of having any with a man of his moral sentiments, I avow. As far as fate shall compel me to sit with him in public affairs, I shall treat him with decency and perfect impartiality." To Abigail, he boasted that he and Jay had held the line on the point of independence, refusing to speak or hear before we were put on an equal foot. Franklin, he told her, as usual, would have taken the advice of the Comte de Vergennes and treated without, but nobody would join him. But in this, Adams was both overstating his own part and being blatantly unfair to Franklin, who had supported the recognition of American independence since the beginning, before Adams ever arrived on the scene. Adams called on Franklin at Passy the same evening that Ridley talked him out the door. He stayed several hours and seized the opportunity to speak frankly of his opinion of the French court, as well as to praise Jay for his firmness. "Franklin," wrote Adams afterward, "heard me patiently, but said nothing." However deep-seated his animosity toward Franklin, Adams did truly treat him with decency and managed to work effectively with him as he had in times past. Adams, Franklin, and Jay met and dined in Paris the next day, and would repeatedly again in the weeks to come. As days passed, Adams found himself even admiring the old conjurer. The turning point came early, at one of the meetings prior to sitting down with the British negotiators, when Franklin, knowing the importance of a united front, told Jay and Adams, "I am of your opinion, and will go on with these gentlemen in the business without consulting this, the French, court." It was a brave decision. In direct conflict with their instructions from Congress, and at risk of alienating the French, they would ignore Vergennes. In his diary, Adams described Franklin as, "with us in entire harmony." Formal sessions with the British negotiators began the morning of October 30th, Adams's 47th birthday, and continued into the last week of November, as snow fell on the city day after day, only to melt as fog set in. Starting at 11 each morning, the meetings took place at Jay's lodgings at the Hôtel d'Orléans on the Rue des Petits Augustins on the left bank, or at Adams's Hôtel du Roi, or the Hôtel de Valentin Roy at Passy to spare Franklin the ride into Paris in such weather, or at Richard Oswald's quarters at the Grand Hôtel Muscovite, also on the Rue des Petits Augustins. Henry Lawrence, who had been released from the Tower of London in exchange for General Cornwallis, was suffering poor health from his captivity and would not appear for the negotiations until the very end. As secretary for the American commissioners, Franklin had selected his grandson, William Temple Franklin, a decision that did not please Adams, who thought John Thaxter better qualified. Temple Franklin was 22, the illegitimate son of Franklin's illegitimate son William, the former Tory governor of New Jersey who was living in London. Also, among a half-dozen other Americans who, like Matthew Ridley, were in and about the discussions or dined with the negotiators as confidential matters were taken up, was Franklin's friend and associate, the spy Bancroft, as well as the young hero, the Marquis de Lafayette, who was home from the war in America. Richard Oswald continued as chief negotiator for the British. Oswald, a Scot, was a merchant who had made a fortune in government contracts and the slave trade. Elderly, blind in one eye, he was favorably inclined toward the American point of view, and agreeable to the point of being unsuited for politics. But he was joined now by Henry Strachey, the Undersecretary of State, sent by Lord Shelburne to stiffen Oswald's resolve. Adams and Franklin had encountered Strachey once before, at Staten Island in 1776 at their meeting with Admiral Lord Howe, when Strachey, serving as Howe's secretary, had kept notes. Adams, who spelled the name Stretchey, described him as an artful, insinuating man who pushed and pressed every point, while a young British career diplomat, Alan Fitzherbert, who served as an assistant, struck Adams as refreshingly without airs. In fact, the British envoys were not particularly impressive. In ability, experience, and resolve, they were hardly a match for Adams, Franklin, and Jay, who, having started from scratch as diplomats, had come a long way in their time in Europe. In his diary, Adams compared the situation between Britain and America to that of an eagle and a cat. The eagle, soaring over a farmer's yard, swept and pounced on the cat, thinking it a rabbit. In the air, the cat seized her by the neck with her teeth and round her body with her fore and hind claws. The eagle, finding herself scratched and pressed, bids the cat let go and fall down. "No," says the cat, "I won't let go and fall. You shall stoop and set me down." The British, it appeared, were more ready to stoop and set America down than ever expected. The fundamental questions to be dealt with after acknowledgement of independence were the boundaries of the United States, the right of navigation on the Mississippi River, debts, the interests of American Tories or Loyalists, and American fishing rights on the Grand Banks off Newfoundland, a main point with Adams. The Americans insisted that Britain cede all territory between the Appalachian Mountains on the east and the Mississippi on the west, and to this the British agreed, thus at a stroke doubling the size of the new nation. The all-important right of the United States to navigation on the Mississippi was also settled. On the question of private debts incurred by Americans to British merchants before the war, Franklin and Jay felt these had been counterbalanced by the American property confiscated or destroyed by the British Army. But Adams strongly objected. Debts contracted in good faith should be paid, he insisted, and such a clause was included, though it would ultimately prove ineffective. The British wanted compensation for the Loyalists. To Henry Strachey, it was essential that such an article be included, as proof to the thousands of American refugees that the British government, to which they had remained faithful, had not forgotten them. It was a point of view difficult for the Americans to accept, having, as they made clear, no sympathy for such people. Strachey departed for London, taking the proposed articles for approval. And in the lull, Adams made his first visit to Versailles since his return to Paris. Vergennes, he had been informed by Lafayette, took it amiss that Adams had not been to see him. Acutely sensitive to all that Vergennes had done to destroy his reputation with Congress, including enlisting Franklin to help make the case against him, Adams was no more eager to see Vergennes than he had been to see Franklin. He traveled the road to Versailles in a state of extreme apprehension, wondering, as he later wrote, whether he was to hear an expostulation, a reproof, an admonition, or, in plain vulgar English, a scolding. Or was there any disposition to forget and forgive, and say, all malice depart? What followed came as a total surprise. Invited to dine, Adams was made much of by both the Comte and Madame la Comtesse, who insisted he sit at her right hand and was remarkably attentive to him. Vergennes was overflowing with friendship. The Comte, who sat opposite, was constantly calling out to me to know what I would eat and offer me petit gâteau, claret and Madeira, etc., etc., Adams recorded. Never had he been treated with such respect at Versailles, and he was pleased beyond measure. "Good treatment makes me think I am admired, beloved. So I dismiss my guard and grow weak, silly, vain," he had once written in his youth, in the throes of painful self-evaluation. Now he was in the full embrace of people who, as he said, made compliments a form of art. "French gentlemen said that I had shown in Holland that Americans understand negotiation as well as war. Another said, 'Monsieur, vous êtes le Washington de la négociation.'" "It is impossible to exceed this," Adams continued in an effusive account in his diary that he was to regret having written. Somehow, perhaps by his own error, these pages from the diary, or peace journal as he called it, would be included with the report that went off to Philadelphia and were later read aloud in Congress to mock Adams for his abject vanity. But what he wrote in the diary and how he responded to the moment were different matters. In the midst of such attentions, he kept his head. When Vergennes pressed for inside information on the course of the negotiations, Adams told him nothing. Nor did the pleasure he found in being so welcomed and fussed over by those who for so long had treated him with condescension or contempt divert him even a little from the conviction that the way of the European powers and their leaders had never been and never would be to the benefit of the United States. When another day Richard Oswald charged Adams with being afraid of becoming the tool of the powers of Europe, Adams replied, "Indeed I am." "What powers?" says he. "All of them," says I. "It is obvious that all the powers of Europe will be continually maneuvering with us, to work us into their real or imaginary balances of power. I think it ought to be our rule not to meddle, and that of all the powers of Europe not to desire us, or perhaps even to permit us to interfere if they can help it." In the meantime, the Comte de Vergennes, through an emissary, had been letting the government in London know confidentially of his opposition to most of the American claims. And to his ambassador in Philadelphia, he had written that France does not feel obliged to sustain the pretentious ambitions of the United States concerning either boundaries or fisheries. Adams was at his best in the final days of negotiations. On November 25th, Henry Strachey returned from London, and the talks resumed at Oswald's lodgings at the Grand Hotel Muscovite. Only 2 points remain to be settled. Recompense for the loyalists and American fishing rights on the Grand Banks off Newfoundland. Adams preferred that nothing be said of the loyalists. Franklin was especially vehement in insisting that they receive no special treatment. In the end, after a vast deal of conversation, the United States promised the Loyalists nothing. It was left that the individual states be requested to provide some form of compensation for property they had confiscated, a gesture that would prove largely meaningless. Another day, Henry Lawrence appeared, like a stark reminder of the pain inflicted by a war that had still to end. To the lingering torments of his time in the Tower had been added the news that his son, Colonel John Lawrence, had been killed in an unimportant action on a nameless battlefield in South Carolina almost a year after Yorktown. Lawrence's one contribution to the proceedings was to provide a line to prevent the British Army from carrying away any Negroes or other property when withdrawing from America. Oswald, who had done business with Lawrence in former years when they were both in the slave trade, readily agreed. It was the argument over the fisheries that nearly brought negotiations to a halt, when Adams, once again unalterably determined, refused to accept any compromise that would impair New England's ancient stake in the sacred codfish. With the same vitality he had once brought to the courtrooms of Massachusetts and the floor of Congress, he championed the right of American fishermen, citing articles from treaties passed and explaining in detail the migratory patterns of the cod, not to say the temperament of seafaring New Englanders. How could we restrain our fishermen, the boldest men alive, from fishing in prohibited places? He asked. Then, just as agreement seemed near, Henry Strachey proposed to amend the line specifying the American right of fishing to read liberty of fishing, to which young Fitzherbert declared the word right to be an obnoxious expression. The moment was one made for Adams. Rising from his chair, smoldering with indignation, he addressed the British. Gentlemen, is there or can there be a clearer right? In former treaties, that of Utrecht and that of Paris, France and England have claimed the right and used the word. When God Almighty made the banks of Newfoundland at 300 leagues distant from the people of America and at 600 leagues distance from those of France and England, did he not give as food a right to the former as to the latter? If heaven in the creation have a right, it is ours at least as much as yours. If occupation, use, and possession have a right, we have it as clearly as you. If war and blood and treasure give a right, ours is as good as yours. We have been constantly fighting in Canada, Cape Breton, and Nova Scotia for the defense of the fishery, and have expanded beyond all proportion more than you. If, then, the right cannot be denied, why, then, should it not be acknowledged and put out of dispute? It was settled. Almost. Article 3 of the treaty would read, "It is agreed that the people of the United States shall continue to enjoy unmolested the right to take fish of every kind on the Grand Bank." However, on the matter of taking fish along the coast of Newfoundland and all other of His Britannic Majesty's dominions in America, the people of the United States were to have the liberty, which, insisted the British negotiators, amounted to the same thing. "We did not think it necessary to contend for a word," wrote a more mellow John Adams years afterward. By the end of the day, there was agreement on everything. Dining that evening at his hotel with Matthew Ridley, Adams was in high spirits. Asked if he would have fish, he laughed and declined, saying he had had a pretty good meal of them already that day. Adams generously praised his fellow negotiators. Franklin, he told Ridley, had performed nobly. But to Jay belonged the greatest credit, Adams said. Jay had played the leading part, Adams felt then and later, never failing to give Jay credit. The following day, Saturday, November 30th, 1782, all parties made their way through still another damp Paris snowfall, again to Oswald's quarters at the Grand Hotel Muscovite for the signing of the preliminary treaty. Oswald was first to fix his name, followed by the four Americans in alphabetical order. In effect, the Americans had signed a separate peace with the British. They had acted in direct violation of both the French-American alliance and their specific instructions from Congress to abide by the advice of the French foreign minister. To Adams, there was no conflict in what they had done. The decision to break with the orders from Congress, and thus break faith with the French, had been clear-cut, the only honorable course. Congress had left them no choice. Congress had prostituted its own honor by surrendering its sovereignty to the French foreign minister. "It is glory to have broken such infamous orders," Adams wrote in his diary. "Infamous, I say, for so they will be to all posterity." To Franklin fell the unpleasant duty of breaking the news to Vergennes. And fortunately so, as in the parlance of diplomacy, it was a delicate moment. As expected, Vergennes was extremely displeased, though surprised was the word he chose. "I am at a loss, sir, to explain your conduct and that of your colleagues in this occasion," he wrote formally to Franklin. What had been signed, Franklin emphasized, were preliminary articles only. Nothing had been agreed to that ran contrary to French interests, and of course no peace could take place until the French and British concluded their talks and the definitive treaty was signed by all parties. Franklin apologized if he and his colleagues had been guilty of neglecting a point of bienséance, propriety. But this was from no want of respect for the king, whom we all love and honor. Then, with a cleverness of the kind he excelled in, Franklin included an afterthought. The English, he said, were now flattering themselves that they had divided the Americans from the French. So it were best that this little misunderstanding be forgotten, and thereby prove the English mistaken. Further, with amazing bravado, Franklin asked Vergennes for a loan of 6 million livres. In truth, Vergennes thought well of the work done by the Americans at the negotiating table. He had no serious objections to the preliminary articles. Indeed, he thought Franklin, Jay, and Adams had obtained considerably more from the British than he had thought possible. "The English buy peace rather than make it," he remarked contemptuously to a French colleague. The little misunderstanding was got over in a matter of days, and Vergennes agreed to the loan. In a letter to Livingston that he never sent, Adams would later contend that Franklin would not have signed the treaty without the knowledge of Vergennes, that Vergennes, in fact, had been in on the whole thing. But Adams, exhausted in strength and spirits, had by then succumbed to one of his spells of gloom, during which he was incapable of seeing either Franklin or Vergennes in any but the darkest light. It was not until late the following summer that the final, or definitive, Treaty of Paris was signed. And in the intervening time, Adams fell once again into a black mood. Again, and with good cause, he felt Congress had forgotten him. He had received no expressions of gratitude or praise for what he had done, nor any sign of what, if anything, Congress had in mind for the future. To Abigail, he described the sharp, fiery humors which break out in the back of my neck and other parts of me and plague me as much as the uncertainty in which I am in for my own future destiny. It was that summer, in a letter of July 22, 1783, to Robert Livingston, that Franklin described Adams in words that were never to be forgotten. "He means well for his country, is always an honest man, often a wise one, but sometimes and in some things absolutely out of his senses." In the first week of September, the peacemakers convened to sign the definitive treaty. Henry Laurens was absent. Thus it was Adams, Franklin, and Jay who represented the United States at the ceremony at the Hotel d'York on the Rue Jacob, and who signed their names in that order, along with a new representative of King George III, David Hartley. In fixing his signature to the document, Adams, as he often did, put a little dash or period after his name, as if to say, "John Adams, period." The all-important first sentence of Article I declared, "His Britannic Majesty acknowledges the said United States to be free, sovereign, and independent states." "Done at Paris," read the final line, "this third day of September, in the year of our Lord 1783. The mighty revolution had ended. The new nation was born. It had been 9 years since the First Continental Congress at Philadelphia, 8 years since Lexington and Concord, 7 since the Declaration of Independence, and more than 3 years since John Adams had last left home in the role of peacemaker. To Thomas Jefferson, Adams would one day write, "My friend, you and I have lived in serious times." And of all the serious events of the exceedingly eventful 18th century, none compared to the arrival upon the world stage of the new, independent United States of America. Adams's part in Holland and at Paris had been profound. As time would tell, the treaty that he, Franklin, and Jay had made was as advantageous to their country as any in history. It would be said they had won the greatest victory in the annals of American diplomacy. For his own part, for the time being, Adams knew for certain only that he was exhausted and intended never again to be separated from Abigail for any extended period for as long as he lived. "You may depend upon a good domestic husband for the remainder of my life, if it is the will of heaven that I should once more meet you," he wrote. And this, he told her, was a promise not lightly made. Whether he should come to her, or she to him, or how soon that could be, remained to be seen. Chapter 6. Abigail in Paris. What a large volume of adventures may be grasped within this little span of life by him who interests his heart in everything. Lawrence Stern, A Sentimental Journey. Section 1. As greatly as she wished it were not so, Abigail Adams was terrified of the sea. She, who had held her ground against war, plague, and abject loneliness, who had faced one dread uncertainty after another through the worst of times, steadfastly, never flinching by all appearances, looked upon hazarding a voyage over the North Atlantic with nothing less than horror. The very thought, she told her husband, made a coward of her. It was not something she could change, he must understand. And as a measure of his love, he must come home to her with all possible speed. "I know not whether I shall believe myself how well you love me unless I can prevail upon you to return." Her mind was much on mortality. The same September of the Paris Peace Treaty, her adored father, the Reverend William Smith, had died in the Weymouth parsonage where she had been born and raised. The last of her parental props had fallen. one of the strongest of her ties to home, was dissolved. Her father had been among the reasons she had never felt free to leave for Europe. "I cannot consent to your going, child, whilst I live," he had told her. Still, though free now, she could not bring herself to go. In the years when John served in Congress, Pennsylvania had seemed that far country. Now her firstborn had seen Russia, and returned to Europe on his own by way of Finland, Sweden, Denmark, and Germany, as she knew from John's letters, though from the boy himself she had not had a line in 2 years. Her two youngest, Charles and Thomas, were away at Haverhill, boarding with her sister Elizabeth and the Reverend John Shaw, who was preparing them for college, Abigail having had a change of mind about John Shaw and his abilities. When she made the 50-mile ride to Haverhill for a visit, it was the farthest from Braintree she had ever traveled. Of her children, only Nabby remained at home. But at 17, Nabby's life, too, was moving on. Fair-haired, pleasing in appearance, she was taller than her mother, more circumspect, less inclined to voice an opinion. A fine, majestic girl who has as much dignity as a princess, in Abigail's description, though she wondered if Nabby was too reserved, too prudent. She has stateliness in her manners, which some misconstrue into pride and a haughtiness, but which rather results from too great reserve. She wants more affability, but she has prudence and discretion beyond her years. She is in her person tall, large, and majestic. Mama's partiality allows her to be a good figure. Her sensibility is not yet which attracts whilst it is attracted. Her manners rather forbid all kinds of intimacy and awe whilst they command. Indeed, she is not like her mama, Abigail confided to John at last. Had not her mama at her age too much sensibility to be very prudent? A young lawyer named Royal Tyler had moved to town, boarding with the Cranches, and was showing interest in Nabby. Nor did he neglect to shower attention on Abigail, who thought highly of him. The son of a wealthy father, valedictorian of his class at Harvard, Tyler was handsome, witty, and well-read. "If he is steady, he will shine in his profession," she wrote. "His disposition appears extremely amiable." She seemed nearly as charmed by him as was Nabby. But there was gossip of dissipation in the young man's past. That he had fathered an illegitimate child by a housemaid at Harvard, and had, besides, squandered his inheritance. Abigail began having second thoughts, and wrote at length on the matter to her distant husband. A growing attachment between the two young people was plain to see. Tyler was spending more and more evenings by their fire, she reported. What should she do? What ought I to say? I feel a powerful pleader within my own heart, and well recollect the love I bore to the object of my early affections to forbid him to have hope. She wondered if perhaps a tender passion might be just the thing for Nabby, to bring her out of herself. Earlier, in a long, affectionate letter to his daughter, John had offered memorable advice on choosing a husband, that in sum expressed what he valued most in a man, and what he so struggled to be himself so much of his life. "Daughter, get you an honest man for a husband, and keep him honest, no matter whether he is rich, provided he be independent. Regard the honor and moral character of the man more than all other circumstances. Think of no other greatness but that of the soul, no other riches but those of the heart. An honest, sensible, humane man, above all the littleness of vanity and extravagances of imagination, laboring to do good rather than be rich, to be useful rather than make a show, living in modest simplicity clearly within his means and free from debts and obligations, is really the most respectable man in society, makes himself and all about him most happy. On the matter of Royal Tyler, he had shown little patience. "I don't like the subject at all," he told Abigail. The girl was too young for such thoughts. Nor did he like Tyler's method of courting mothers. "Abigail and Tyler both had advanced too fast, and I should advise both to retreat." "I don't like your word dissipation at all. I don't know what it means. My child is a model, as you represent her and as I know her, and is not to be the prize, I hope, of any reformed rake. In the name of all that is tender, don't criticize your daughter for those qualities which are her greatest glory, her reserve and her prudence." By the autumn of 1783, the romance had been suspended, though, as Abigail reported, the young man's attachment had not lessened. As for Nabby, she would do nothing without her father's approval. It was another reason why John was needed at home, to appraise the situation for himself. Abigail had a melancholy sense of life slipping away before she and John had had a chance to enjoy it. She had turned 39. The face in the mirror was a young woman no longer. And where, she asked in one especially plaintive letter, was that young, untitled John Adams she had fallen in love with? "I recollect the untitled man to whom I gave my heart, and in the agony of recollection, when time and distance present themselves together, wish he had never been any other. Who shall give me back my time? Who shall compensate to me those years I cannot recall? How dearly have I paid for a titled husband." Hearing he might be appointed ambassador to the British court, she begged him to refuse. She had no desire to live in England, no wish for the parade and nonsense of a public role. She was too inclined to wear her heart on her countenance, she reminded him. "I am sure I would make an awkward figure, and then it would mortify my pride if I should be thought to disgrace you." Her health was poor. She tired easily and suffered from headaches. "Neither of us appear built for duration," she wrote. "Would to heaven the few remaining days allotted to us might be enjoyed together." His letters from Paris, written in September, pressed her to sail as soon as possible. Congress had appointed him to a new commission to negotiate a commercial treaty with Britain. She must come. She could sail for London, Amsterdam, or any port in France. The moment he heard of her arrival, he would fly to her. "Even by balloon, if such travel were perfected in time," he added lightheartedly. But it was only on hearing that he had suffered another serious illness that she changed her mind and resolved to go to him. Except for her marriage itself, it was the most important decision she had ever had to make. A fever, like that at Amsterdam, had laid him low, she read in a letter written October 14th, one of the last she was to receive before Boston's harbor was closed by winter ice. He was leaving for London for his health, and taking John Quincy with him. She must come soon. Concerning the courtship, the family affair on her mind, that could be managed quite well, Adams wrote. "The lady comes to Europe with you. If the parties preserve their regard until they meet again and continue to behave as they ought, they will still be young enough." She began making plans, though not without dire apprehensions. "You invite me to you. You call me to follow you. The most earnest wish of my soul is to be with you. But you can scarcely form an idea of the conflict in my mind. It appears to me such an enterprise, the ocean so formidable, the quitting of my habitation and my country, leaving my children, my friends, with the idea that perhaps I may never see them again, without my husband to console and comfort me under these apprehensions. Indeed, my dear friend, there are hours when I feel unequal to the trial. In January, after further consideration, John wrote again to say that if she thought it inadvisable to come to Europe, he would come to her. As for Nabby, he continued, I can scarcely think it possible for me to disapprove of her final judgment formed with deliberation upon anything which so deeply concerns her whole happiness. Then, having looked into the young man's background and reputation for himself, as much as that was possible at such a distance, Adam sent another letter, this to Tyler himself. Sir, you and the young lady have my consent to arrange your plans according to your own judgment, Adams wrote, and I pray God to bless and prosper you both, whether together or asunder. But neither letter would arrive in time. Seeing to the necessary arrangements kept Abigail occupied well into spring. As John had advised, she and Nabby were to be accompanied by two servants, Esther Field and John Breesler, both of Braintree. Uncle Isaac Smith, the Boston merchant, was to look into proper passage, while another uncle, Dr. Cotton Tufts of Weymouth, who had been advising Abigail on land investments, was to manage the family's financial affairs in her absence. The farm was leased. But the house and all their possessions, Abigail decided to leave in the care of a former slave of her father's named Phoebe, who had been freed by his will and was newly married to a free black man, William Abdi. As there was no settled minister in Weymouth, Abigail told John, I gave them the liberty of celebrating their nuptials here, which they did, much to their satisfaction. That the couple would remain in her house in her absence, however long that might be, gave her particular peace of mind. I have no doubt of their care and faithfulness, and prefer them to any other family. In characteristic fashion, she specified exactly how things were to be. They are, during the present year, to have the use of the garden east of the house, and that part of the great garden next to the road and all the fruit which grows in the garden, she instructed Cotton Tufts. Phoebe is to be allowed a pint of milk a day. I give her also a pig 7 weeks old, 3 pounds of hog's lard, and what salt beef there is in the house. The house and furniture are to be taken care of by opening and airing, rubbing and cleaning it. They are to be allowed use of the team in the fall to bring up a load of seaweed. The library is to be under the care of Mr. Cranch. No books to be lent out unless to him and Mr. Tyler. In November, you will be so good as to give on my account the sum of $2 to Widow Abigail Field, $2 to the Widow Sarah Owen, who lives in the same house with her sister Field, $1 to Mrs. Fuller, and $1 to the widow Mary Howard, and $1 to the wife of John Hayden, who is an aged woman and one of my pensioners. $1 to the widow Mary Green. By the end of May, all was arranged. She had passage to England on the merchant ship Active, which was expected to sail within a few weeks. She had hoped to embark with friends. As it was, she knew none of the other passengers or the captain. She would not be sailing in winter, nor in the midst of war. Still, it was a venture that she had once thought nothing could ever tempt her to undertake. But let no person say what they would or would not do, since we are not judges for ourselves until circumstances call us to act, she wrote to John on May 25th. In her last letter before leaving. Day by day she had looked for some word from him, but there was none. My thoughts are fixed, my latest wish depends on thee, guide, guardian, husband, lover, friend, she wrote, borrowing from one of her poets. Abigail said her farewells in her front parlor on the morning of June 18th. the house filled with neighbors, not of unmeaning complimenters, she wrote, but the honest yeomanry, their wives and daughters like a funeral procession, all come to wish me well and to pray for a speedy return. She had tried to prepare for the moment. Knowing I had to act my little part alone, I had possessed myself with calmness, but this was too much for me. She and everyone around her were weeping as she shook hands one by one. In Boston, at Isaac Smith's house the following day, Thomas Jefferson appeared out of the blue to introduce himself and say that he, too, was soon to sail with his daughter, Martha, and a young mulatto slave, James Hemings. He had been appointed by Congress to join the commissioners, Franklin and Adams, in Paris. Thinking it important that he know more of the commercial interests of New England, he had been making a quick tour of Connecticut and Rhode Island, and had only just arrived in Boston. What Abigail's first impressions of Jefferson were during this encounter, or what he thought of her, neither recorded. Jefferson intended to depart from New York in July and urged her to go with him. But her plans were made, her passage paid for. "I thanked him for his politeness," she reported to John, "but having taken my measures, I was determined to abide by them." Like Abigail, Jefferson had never been to sea. As it turned out, he would sail from Boston after all, and only weeks later, crossing under sunny skies, the sea, as his daughter said, as calm as a river. Abigail sailed on June 20th, 1784. At age 39, having never been away from either her home or those of close relatives for more than a night or two in all her life, she, Nabby, their two servants, and a cow went on board the Active at Rose Wharf and with a fine wind were quickly underway. Among the few other passengers, as Abigail recorded, were a Colonel Norton from Martha's Vineyard, a Dr. Clark, a Mr. Foster, a Mr. Spear, a haughty Scotchman named Green, and one other woman whose name happened also to be Adams. No sooner had the ship passed the Boston Lighthouse into rougher water than they were all horribly seasick. And so it was to be for days. Everyone tossed about in cramped, excessively disagreeable quarters together. We crawled upon the deck whenever we were able, but it was so cold and damp that we could not remain long, Abigail wrote. The ship was filthy and carried a cargo of whale oil and potash. With every roll of the waves, the whale oil leaked, the potash smoked and fermented, contributing further to the flavor below. The staterooms for the women comprised two tiny airless cabins opening onto the main cabin where meals were served and the men slept. Nabby and the other Mrs. Adams were in one cabin, while Abigail and Esther Field shared the other. At night, to keep from suffocating, they had to leave the doors open onto the main cabin. "We can only live with our door shut whilst we dress and undress," Abigail wrote in a journal she began for her sister Mary Cranch. "Necessity has no law, but what should I have thought on shore to have laid myself down to sleep in common with a half-dozen gentlemen? We have curtains, it is true, and we only partly undress, but we have the satisfaction of falling in with a set of well-behaved, decent gentlemen." In a storm off the Grand Banks, with bottles and plates crashing to pieces all about them, the women had to be held fast in their chairs as some gentleman sat by us with his arm fastened in ours and his feet braced against a table or chair that was lashed down. Afterward, the sailors assured her it had been only a breeze. Yet the hard rocking of the ship had so badly injured her cow that the animal had to be killed and cast overboard. In the unrelieved dampness below decks, Abigail suffered severely from rheumatism, The food was inedible. The cook she described as a lazy, dirty Negro with no more knowledge of his business than a savage. But with a favorable turn in the weather, finding she could get about, her usual spirit returned. And very like John Adams on board the Boston, she proceeded to make a bustle, in her expression. And as I found I might reign mistress on board without any offense, I soon exerted my authority with scrapers, mops, brushes, infusions of vinegar, etc., and in a few hours you would have thought yourself in a different ship. She took up the direction of our cabin, as she wrote in another account for her sister Elizabeth, taught the cook to dress his victuals, and have made several puddings with my own hands. When she mastered the names of all the masts and sails, the captain said he was sure she could take over at the helm as well. Unlike John, she loved watching the sea. Wrapped in an old camblet cloak, she spent hours on deck, her soul filled with feelings of the sublime. After a night of brilliant phosphorescence in the water, a phenomenon she had longed to witness, she wrote in ecstasy of a blazing ocean as far as she could see. "Great and marvelous are thy works, Lord God Almighty," she recorded reverently. With Nabby, she passed the time in the main cabin, reading, writing, chatting,